And even if you do run into the ditch, how many options do you have for getting out? It fascinates me to hear the criticism of Michael as the owner and GM of the Charlotte Bobcats. After 4 years as a minority partner, Michael took control in 2010 and became the first former player to become the majority owner of an NBA team. Cleaner law? If your name is on the door, you'd better control what goes on behind that door. Right away, the critics pounced on the team's poor performance, questioning whether the Bobcats' failure would tarnish Michael's legacy, and comparing him to other players who had made the leap to management. Larry Bird, Joe DeMars, Jerry West. Great executives who did great things with the teams they worked for. But that's the difference. They all worked for someone else. Michael is working for himself. It's his money, his name on that door. There's a big difference between being hired for a job that you'll eventually leave, voluntarily or involuntarily, and owning the business, which has never before been done in the NBA by a former player. How can you fail at something that's never been done, when there's no previous measure of success? After a terrible 2011-2012 season, he blamed no one, took full responsibility for the team situation, and said he was going to figure it out. Probably doesn't help that the team's best player is actually its owner. But when Michael says, "I never want to be in the record books for failure," as he told reporters after the season, believe him. Let's make this simple. Failure is what happens when you decide you failed. Until then, you're still always looking for ways to get where you want to be. It's Derek Jeter responding to a reporter who asked if the Yankees were panicking during a late-season slump and how Jeter was dealing with it. He said, "I don't panic, so I don't have to deal with it." Total cleaner. Or Dallas Cowboys tight end Jason Witten, offering to sign a medical waiver so he could return to action with a lacerated spleen against doctor's orders. It's Dwayne refusing to go down with that bad knee in the playoffs, or Kobe refusing to sit out with multiple injuries, including the concussion, that would have staggered anyone else. That's how you decide to not fail. You go, and you go, always looking for the unexpected option that keeps the situation in your control. Success and failure are 100% mental. One person's idea of success might seem like a complete failure to someone else. You must establish your own vision of what it means to be unstoppable. You can't let anyone else define that for you. What does your gut tell you? What do your instincts know about what you should be doing, how you're going to succeed, and what you're going to succeed at? How can anyone tell you what that should be? When someone else says you've failed, what they really mean is, if that were me, I would feel like a failure. Well, that guy's not you, and he's obviously not a cleaner, because cleaners don't recognize failure. I understand the challenge of fighting back against all odds while others want you to fail. When I built the Attack Athletics facility in Chicago in 2007, I had already been in business for almost 20 years. I had already worked with the best athletes in the world, traveled to places and seen things others can only dream of, and I wanted to take Attack Athletics to the next level. Everyone said it was the final stage in my evolution as a trainer. But to me, it was just the beginning. I built a state-of-the-art athletic training facility that brought people from all over the world, a place that no other individual trainer could ever have dreamed of building and owning. I had certain expectations and plans, and they all came to fruition. The new venture was everything I wanted it to be. But as with any business, unexpected situations force you to make adjustments, and I was faced with difficult decisions that would change the direction of the facility. Players facing the NBA lockout didn't want to make the financial investment in their training without the certainty of a season. My major clients, Kobe, Dwayne, and many others, understandably wanted me wherever they were, so I was all over the world with them while my building was sitting in Chicago. Hard way to run a business. And before long, there was some buzz about the failure of Attack Athletics. What happened with the building was a setback. But dealing with setbacks is how you achieve success. You learn, and you adapt. When everyone else is talking about how you failed, you show up like a professional, remap your course, and get back to work. That's the progression of good, great, unstoppable. No one starts at unstoppable. You fuck up. You figure it out. You trust yourself. Let me say this. Attack Athletics is who I am and what I do. It's not a building. The building was about equipment, an environment, and a revolutionary concept. Attack Athletics is me and my training philosophy, and it goes wherever I go. Attack Athletics is the work I do all over the world, and I work hard to be sure that my clients and I don't fail at anything we do. We always find a way to make it work. But when you're the best at anything, you wear a big target on your back. When your colleagues and friends and enemies start talking and sniping behind your back, you know you've done something right if they care that much about you and your business, and whether you're going to lose. Lose? What I lose, you never had. A cleaner never sees failure because to him it's never over. If something doesn't go as planned, he instinctively looks for options to make things work a different way. He doesn't feel embarrassed or ashamed. He doesn't blame anyone else, and he doesn't care what anyone else says about his situation. It's never the end. It's never over. And he knows without a doubt that whatever happens, he'll find a way to come out on top. If you ever find me and a bear wrestling in the woods, help the bear. Make the choice to turn failure into success. If your team doesn't win a championship, if your business falls apart, if you don't achieve something you worked for, move to the next step in your evolution. Remember who you are and how you got this far. Listen to your gut. What is it telling you? It's never over. You have choices. The cooler admits defeat. The closer works hard, but the cleaner strategizes for a different outcome. Admitting defeat has no place in this discussion, or in this book, because the words quit and relentless just don't work together in any productive way. People who admit defeat and say they had no choice just aren't serious about success, excellence, or themselves. They say they'll try, and then give up when that doesn't work. Fuck try. Trying is an open invitation to failure. Just another way of saying, if I fail, it's not my fault. I tried. You tried your best, or did you do your best? Huge difference. Well, I tried. Okay, now tell me what you did. Do or don't do. Do it. And if it doesn't work, do it again. Did you do it this way? That way? Did you explore every idea you had? Is there anything else you could possibly do to turn things in your favor? If you aim at excellence, you have to be willing to sacrifice. That is the price of success. You never know how bad you want it until you get that first bitter taste of not getting it. But once you taste it, you're going to fight like hell to get that bitterness out of your mouth. Maybe you got benched, or you lost a lot of money, or someone else got the promotion you wanted. Others might give up, and they'll be the first to say you should give up too. But did you stop because you wanted to, or because they told you to? Is there still work to be done? Do you still feel the anger inside you, driving you to take action and turn things around? A closer will keep going until he's forced to stop. Remember, he's called a closer because he's there at the end. But once the end arrives, he knows it, he feels it. It's over. A cleaner can't ever accept that it's over. but he does recognize when it's time to change direction. One of the hardest things to do is to change course once you've set your goals. You made a decision. You worked for it. You earned the payoff. But for whatever reason, it's not going the way you planned. It's not weak to recognize when it's time to shift directions. It's weak to refuse to consider other options and fail at everything because you couldn't adapt to anything. We've all been there. You just know something's not right. Maybe you're not advancing as quickly as you planned, or you're not making the money you anticipated, or maybe you just don't like what you're doing or whom you're doing it with, or maybe events outside of your control have impacted your situation. This is where instinct is the most valuable tool you can possibly possess, because only you can decide whether to hear what that voice inside is telling you. In pro sports, it's the decision to retire or to take a shot at one more season. For a young athlete, it's deciding whether to sit on the bench or to find a new sport to play. In business, it can be the choice to change careers or jobs, start or sell a business. In any situation, it's the courage and confidence to know it's time to make a change. It takes a special person to say enough is enough and know when it's time to start redirecting your effort into something that can succeed. Maybe your dream isn't going to play out the way you originally envisioned it, but with some creativity and vision, you can redirect your goals towards something that keeps you connected to what you always wanted. I can tell myself with no hesitation that I'm the best at what I do. I earned it. But to become the best, I had to learn a lot of lessons about always being prepared to change direction and refusing to get sucked into other people's opinions of what it means to succeed or fail. The first time I learned that lesson, I was a basketball player at University of Illinois Chicago with big dreams and a torn ACL. A botched rehab led to hip issues, leg issues, more knee issues. I have more orthopedic issues than you can imagine. I had no idea at that time that my greatest weakness would become my greatest strength, that experiencing every possible injury and surgery would allow me to help others to deal with the same at the most elite level. I was a pretty good player, but not NBA caliber. I just wasn't ready to admit it. When I suffered that first injury, all I wanted to do was play basketball. I'm not the most religious person, but to me, the torn ACL was a message saying, "Listen, you're spending too much time trying to work on this game. It's not going to happen. So let's just bust up your knee so you can focus on what you're supposed to do with your life and get you on the right path faster." But I wasn't ready to look at a different ending for my dream. I kept playing, wearing a big brace on my messed up knee, and trying to overcome the aftermath of the injury and disastrous rehab. Then one day, the turning point. I was playing in a tournament, and this kid I didn't even know came up to me and said, "I remember when you were good." Oh. Got it. That was the wake-up call. The message I needed to realize I was forcing a situation that had no chance of succeeding. It wasn't about the kid's comment. He was only saying what I already knew. I just hadn't accepted it yet. I played in one pickup game after that, and that was it. It was time to find a new ending for that dream. Learn. Adapt. I realized if my damaged body couldn't help me play basketball, I would use what I learned and find a way to turn it into something positive. And I could already see what it was. I didn't want to work for a team. I wanted to work for myself. Take someone in basketball and make him better than he was before. That was how I would make my mark on the NBA. I guess it worked. Of course, it took me a little longer to figure out how that dream was actually going to take shape. I was still chasing Brad Sellers and the rest of the Bulls, writing them all letters, offering my training services. No one responded. I assumed Michael Jordan would be the least likely to hire a trainer, especially one who had never trained a professional athlete, so I never even contacted him. That's how I learned. Don't try. Do. Today I teach the best of the best to take care of their bodies because when I hit initial roadblocks, I refused to see my situation as a failure. You take what everyone else sees as a negative and turn it to your advantage. You don't sulk. You don't curl up and die. You glare at it and think, if it's not going to happen this way, it's sure as hell going to happen that way. And you tell anyone who doubts you, I got this. Just don't expect everyone else to understand or agree with your new plan. Most people are either content to stay with the safe thing, or they're too scared to leave a bad thing, and they'll put all that fear and doubt on you. They anticipate failure. You anticipate opportunity. When I decided to go into this field, everyone said, "Oh, a gym teacher." No. A personal trainer? No. I am not a personal trainer. A personal trainer meets you at the gym for an hour, helps you with your workout, and sees you the next time you want an appointment. I work for my clients 7 days a week, 365 days a year, around the clock. You need me, I'm there. You can call me an architect or an athletic specialist. An architect constructs a building. I construct a body from the inside out. How do I rebuild that shoulder? How do I structure that physique so it's stronger and more durable and powerful than ever before? I'm a physical architect, responsible for every fiber of that mind and body you've entrusted to me. All because I failed as a basketball player. To me, success isn't about how much money I can make. It's never been about that. Success is about doing things that no one else can do. A couple of years ago, I spent the summer working with Robbie Hummel, who was playing for Purdue, a great kid who had just torn his ACL for the second time in 8 months. The first time, in 2010, he was a junior with just 8 games left in the season and was already considered one of the top players in the country. Determined to get back to the game, he went through surgery and rehab with trainers at school and returned to the Boilermakers that following season for his senior year, ready to play. At the very first team practice, he tore the ACL again. Out for the season, and possibly forever. 2 surgeries in 8 months? Returning from a double ACL injury? That's a lot of work for an uncertain outcome. There was talk that the promising career of the 6'8" All-American forward might be over. That's when his dad called me. Could I get him back to where he needed to be, so he could have one more shot as a fifth-year senior? I don't know anyone else in my business who has successfully rehabbed even 1 double ACL injury, but Robbie would be my 3rd. I knew what we'd have to do for him. It would take months of commitment and serious mental toughness. His choice. For 7 months, he worked on that rehab 5 days a week, twice a day, at the Attack Athletics facility in Chicago and also back at school in Valparaiso. He'd drive an hour each way to see us, and I think he was a little stunned by how fast and hard we put him to work. The first day I figured they'd talk to me and take my height and weight, he told reporters. Within an hour, they had me puking in a trash can. Our goal was to have him at full strength by the start of Big Ten conference play for the 2011-2012 season. People said it was impossible. His surgeon had cleared him to play, but he still had 1 test to pass for me before I'd give him the green light. A 48-inch jump down to the floor and back up. Same test I give all my guys after knee or ankle or hip rehab. The day he finally achieved that was the day we said goodbye and sent him back to school, good to go. Our job was done, and his was just beginning. Not only did he return to the game better than ever, He went on to be named first-team All-Big Ten for the third time in his career, ranking in the top 10 for scoring, rebounds, blocks, three-pointers, and free throws. And in his final appearance in the NCAA tournament, he dominated with 26 points, including 5 three-pointers, in a narrow loss to Kansas. By then, we were no longer working together, but I was so pleased for him when he was drafted in the second round of the NBA draft and then headed to Spain to start his professional career, where he promptly tore his meniscus. More surgery, more work, more commitment. A lot of guys would quit. He kept going. It's all a choice. I tell my athletes everything up front and let them decide whether to keep fighting or give up. Tracy McGrady was facing an 18-month process to rehab his knee, and he had to make a tough choice. Are you willing to give up 2 years of your career so when you're 40 or 50, you'll still have a perfect knee? Or are you willing to take a chance and cut those 18 months in half, work for a super strong knee that's going to last you through your whole career, and deal with the remaining issues when you're done playing? That's not a decision I can make for him, but no one ever chooses the longer rehab. In these cases, I offer choices, and the athletes have to decide what they want to do. You can be good by playing it safe. You can't be relentless unless you are willing to take chances. Safe makes you good. Chances make you great. Gilbert Arenas is another who decided to take the chance with his body. I told him, you have about 100 degrees flexion in this knee. 3 years from now, you're going to have about 90 degrees. 7 years from now, maybe 75. Gil's question, how much flexion do I need to play? I said around 45. He said, okay, I'm good. We knew we could get Gilbert back 100% because any individual who's willing to pack up all his stuff and relocate to Chicago to spend 3 months being tortured by me is already in the right frame of mind. And those huge decisions ultimately determine success or failure. Whom do they trust? The doctors have to give the full medical opinion for a complete recovery. They're going to treat your symptoms. I'm going to overcome the cause. The teams and sponsors want the guys back on the floor as fast as possible. The agents are thinking about how to play the situation so it works for the next contract. I just look at the damage, talk to everyone, and give the guys options. If you do this, you get this. If you do that, you get that. Here's what caused the injury. Here's what we'll do so it doesn't happen again. Your call. Being trusted with those life-altering, high-stakes decisions is what makes me feel successful. Money is nice, but it's better to help someone who doesn't have much time left to excel at something. I love a guy like Juwan Howard, who came into the league in 1994 and for almost 20 years worked his ass off year-round for the opportunity to get a ring, which he finally achieved with the Heat in 2012. You know how much work that takes in your late 30s? To stay in condition and keep making those teams just because you refuse to go down without that ultimate prize? That's a guy who refused to accept failure and came away a winner. With athletes, you have to realize that every day brings them closer to the end of their careers, closer to that decision about whether to walk away or go harder. How can I enhance whatever time they have left so they can be successful? That's where I look for my success. They all want it to last forever and see the end of their careers as some kind of loss. But it doesn't have to be if they've put the pieces in place ahead of time. I've had this conversation over and over with guys nearing the end of their careers. I say, in 1 year, you're going to be irrelevant. You'll leave a legacy as a player, but what does that mean when you get up every day with nothing to do? Figure it out now, before you're just another ex-player looking for attention. Your shoe deal won't last forever, and only so many guys are going to be able to coach or sit in the broadcast booth. What's your plan? How do you turn this great career into something even greater, so you can continue to be unstoppable for years to come? Do it now, because if you wait too long, those other options start slipping away. Other people are chasing the same ideas, and they're getting ahead of you while you cling to this old thing that's not working. A cleaner knows when to walk away and which direction to walk. Never running, always walking. He leaves smoothly and on his own terms. He can lose a battle because he's still planning to win the war. Lose a game, but win the season. Lose a season, come back and win the next three. Lose a job, start a new business. No one else is getting the last word on whether he succeeded. When you're a cleaner, you don't celebrate your achievements because you always want more. A cooler is the first to arrive at the celebration and the last to leave. A closer will make an appearance, then go out with his own crew. But a cleaner just wants to get back to work. I'm not here for the parade. By the time my client wakes up the next day drenched in party sweat and a champagne-soaked victory t-shirt, I'm long gone. We'll find each other for a couple of minutes when it's all over, and that's it. You good? I'm good. Done. Next? A cleaner's favorite words. There's always more work to do, and more to prove. Always more to prove. Let everyone else celebrate. You're still not satisfied. If you won in 6, you're disappointed you didn't win in 5. If you benched 195, why not 200? If you made a deal for $1 million, you'll keep wondering if you could have done it for $1.2 million. Never satisfied. On the rare occasions when you do feel like celebrating, it's a brief, private moment you don't share with anyone else because no one could possibly understand what you went through to get to that point. The others can celebrate because you made it all possible. They may not even realize that, but you do. Everything you accomplished, everything you worked for, you didn't do any of it for the celebration, and you didn't do it for anyone else. You did it for that exquisite moment, that electrifying, powerful surge of satisfaction that everyone dreams about, but few ever get to experience. Yet, the minute you experience it, it's already fading, and all you can think about is doing whatever it takes to get it back. It's that momentary feeling of enough, followed by a deep, hot surge of more. A cleaner knows the quiet melancholy of victory. While everyone else enjoys the win, he waits for the impending letdown, the unyielding reminder that the glory is already in the past, and there's a new challenge ahead, bigger and harder and more grueling than whatever he just completed. If you want to find the cleaner at a victory party, look for the guy standing off to the side by himself, watching everyone else. He's happy for them because they can go home feeling that their work is complete. But his is always just beginning. He's already thinking about the next move, the next risk, the next kill. Watch Pat Riley the next time he wins a title. No one looks more subdued at a celebration. He knows too well what it took to get there and what has to be done to stay there. A true cleaner is at his lowest soon after he reaches his highest. For 5 minutes, he's completely exhilarated. For the next 24 hours, he's relatively happy. After that, what? Back to work. Everyone else will tell him he did a great job, and he knows it's true.